Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and with us today is special guest Michael Kester. We have two films today.
Yeah.
Those films are Joyride and The Attic Expeditions.
That is true.
We're going to spoil both of those films.
To death.
Also, something about Chapters.
And Bruce Willis.
So today we have Jeremy Kasten on the show, the director of The Attic Expeditions. Much like our last show with Mike Wilson, we're still new to this whole interview thing, so the show's probably going to be really fucking long. If the show's too long for you, you can subscribe in iTunes and use the chapter menu. And that way you can skip right to Joyride, skip right to The Attic Expeditions, or even just skip right to the interview. Before we get into any of that, though, we've been talking a lot on the show about how the way we pair the two films doesn't make any fucking sense. So I think we need to give an update regarding our format.
Okay, well, we went through and spent like 96 hours mapping out, pairing up the remaining shows for this fiscal year.
Which was hard because each of us have only seen half of them.
Right.
And we had to pair them and we didn't really, we tried to pair them thematically the best we could.
Plus we ended up losing films and adding films we didn't really want to do and pairing some of them up that didn't make any sense. But that's beside the point. We put those early, so they'll be coming up sooner than later.
Joyride and The Attic Expeditions, for instance.
And then coming up after we kind of fill out these 52 weeks of the double feature podcast that you all know and possibly even subscribe to, we're going to change up format and we're going to kind of drop the whole I haven't seen, you haven't seen thing.
One, because it's just hard to explain and no one gets it. And two, because as we mentioned day one, it was probably a bad idea.
Well, the biggest flaw there being is we didn't start this as soon as we met each other.
Right.
So most of the bulk of our best films in our collections have been seen by both of us and would not be covered under this format.
Yeah. So we want to talk about those. So we're going to start pairing up more legitimate double features. Mm-hmm. The kind of double features that if you were fishing around in iTunes and found a podcast called Double Feature, you would expect us to tackle.
Yeah.
So we're over halfway through. I mean, well, if you're still listening at this point, we're almost there.
Yep.
So we have a few films that just aren't going to make it into the show.
Yeah.
We'll probably still see them.
Yeah.
But we're just probably not going to talk about
if
them on
the really
show.
If you really want us to cover one of the films that you know we have or you assume we have, just do that email thing with the red letters and the
doublefeatureshow@gmail.com.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get into Joyride.
Let's get right into it.
Joyride is a John Dahl film.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger name attached to this would be J.J. Abrams.
Yeah, but it was before even he had a big enough name.
Yeah, right. It's one of his earlier projects. John Dahl's also, you know, he did a lot of the neo-noir stuff in the early 90s. But I think more recently he's done a lot of TV work. So I think we'll naturally get into the J.J. Abrams stuff.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about one of the characters in this right away.
Yeah.
That's one of the things.
Steve Zahn, right?
Yeah. Fuller.
Yeah.
So we've debated back and forth about comedies because of all the films we mutually like, I think we disagree a lot on comedies.
Yeah. With the exception of like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
And Death to Smoochie.
And Death to Smoochie.
Dark comedies especially in our history of shows have always been something we debated about. This is a kind of he's the comedic relief, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, okay, we'll get into this.
Partially, yeah. He's the kind of character and the sort of comedy he uses is something I haven't really seen a lot, especially in the shows we've talked about.
No, I think it's really good, and I think that the use of him as comic relief works really well because you get these scenes where everything's really tense, and once Fuller's tense, you know that there's like bad shit going down.
Yeah, there's really tension.
Yeah,
right.
Because he's a super lighthearted, funny guy, and once he's not being funny anymore, you know that there's a problem.
Well, and the comic relief here isn't done to relieve the tension.
Right.
If anything, it's the opposite because you have this rapport between the two brothers and later between him and Venna, and when there's tension, he doesn't cut the tension, he adds to it by being tense himself. I also think he's charismatic enough and honestly comical enough that works for me. It wears a little thin by the end as any comic relief character does, I think. But I still really enjoyed it. And I kind of wish, you know, maybe the situation is a death trap, right? Because I want to see it more in film. But once you see it more in film, then it becomes sort of a cliche and you see that character all the time. So it's not as fresh. But I wish people would maybe just take as many fresh choices in writing or in actors as we got here.
Right.
So this film's kind of a mixed bag for me as far as stuff it does successfully and doesn't. I'm just going to drag this out right away because the parallels are almost uncanny. You have The Hitcher, right?
Yeah.
The Hitcher, we talked about it in a previous show. It's a film I really liked and would have been a great double feature.
Yeah.
For double feature year two. I mean, those are the kind of things we want to set up. Mm-hmm. Films that in an exploitation style almost seem to go together, like Joyride and The Hitcher. But you have that sort of section in the beginning of The Hitcher, which is set up a lot different than once the film really kicks into the darker tone.
Right.
And you have the same thing here. You have people developing rapport, and really until they get the CB radio and even a little bit after that, the film kind of has a different tone to it.
Mm-hmm.
The best way that they transition you into that new tone is through the really artsy first hotel shot.
Mm-hmm.
You have them in this hotel. It's raining out. You got the lightning outside, the thunder, the 5.1 mix, and the lighting most specifically. You have the green, and later you get a bit of the red too, the harsh red lighting. But you have a lot of that sickening green lighting. Mm-hmm. Before that became a real convention in horror stuff,
yeah,
especially right. Recently, you see a lot of that. And in an even more like gritty, contrasted way than you saw here. They're in this hotel. They're across from this painting, one on the left side of the cheesy hotel painting and one on the right. And the camera moves in really close. I mean, it's a very, very art house kind of shot. And while this tension is building and you're first getting kind of a intimate glimpse of the killer, it's zooming in on this painting and the tension is probably, I would say, as thick as it is through the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the tension ever you have a climax building that's kind of done better. You have chase scenes and things of that nature. But I don't know, for my money, I think that's when the tension is highest in the whole film.
I can agree with that. I think what I really like about the film is that it goes in and out of extreme tension with no in between. There's never like this is kind of tense.
Yeah.
And it's always just like, this is tense. Okay, we're good. No, we're not.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wait. Yeah, we are. No, we're not.
Yeah.
Like, for example, you have the best scene where I think it goes like, if there were a tensometer, which I forgot mine at home.
Right.
If I had brought my tensometer and I had it pointed at your console today, the scene where Steve Zahn and Paul Walker are in the car and yelling at Rusty Nail, being like, you're crazy, you need drugs and all that. You get the scene just following where Rusty Nail's like, you really ought to get that fixed.
Right.
And Steve Zahn's like, get what fixed? And he's like, your tail light. The tensometer breaks in my hand.
Which is what that scene attempts to accomplish.
And it's fantastic.
I think it does it really well. I think the reason I think the first hotel scene is so tense is because you're still kind of fresh to the scenario. You don't really know the formula of the film yet, which it does kind of fall into a formula. You know, it stops being as unexpected as it was early on.
Right.
And you don't know what's going to happen. You know, you don't know how the film, for instance, is going to treat scare shots, which the film, you know, I think that's a fault of it. It takes some pretty obvious scare shots, which sort of diminish the character of it.
Yeah.
And as we've talked about, it's a shame that we didn't do Joyride first and then a lot of these other films. Because more recently, especially and in the films we've covered since, you know, like day two with Cabin Fever and with Hatchet, the thing that they do most interestingly is take scenes that should have scare shots and put them elsewhere.
Right.
Or Silence of the Lambs, for instance, which just has no scare shots. And I think they make more interesting choices there, whereas this film kind of, it goes for where you would expect to put scare shots.
Yeah. And
not so much a fault of this film, but things that were definitely built on it since then or with other films of the time.
Well, the recurrence of the scare shots in this film, I think, is where you get the strength of them. Regardless of whether or not you think they're cheap, they're always the same thing. It's always a phone or a truck.
Yep.
And it's never anything else. And the phone, they use really sparingly.
Mm-hmm.
But the truck, they use all the time.
Yeah.
And they use the truck for like the physical scaring. And they use the CB to upset you emotionally.
Yeah.
And that, like you said while we were watching the film, the killer should just be legs, a torso with a CB radio for a head.
Yeah.
If there were a way to get around it, not supernaturally, the film would probably benefit from just being a truck that talked to you by a CB radio.
Right. Yeah. Well, the CB radio is kind of, I don't want to call it an homage, but it's sort of the one thing that's taken most often from Kubrick's film 2001.
Yeah.
You know, HAL, the computer, which really, when you watch the film, isn't a large component of the film, but it's one of the most iconic things that people really remember and enjoy for that film. And it worked there. And I think it works just as well here. And it's one of those classic kind of J.J. Abrams ideas. You see that again with Cloverfield, where they kind of take certain marketing ideas or things that weren't actually capitalized on from the Escape from New York movies, for instance. The marketing prominently featured the head of the Statue of Liberty, which in the film doesn't.
Right.
And he kind of looked at that and said, you know, there's an icon. Let's actually use that in a film. And I think you see the same kind of thing here with the callback to 2001, where it was like, you know, Hal's not really prominently featured in 2001.
Yeah.
And that's what people liked about it. Let's take that kind of idea and apply it to this sort of on the run horror genre.
Right.
And that's the thing that I think works most brilliantly that this film has going for it. Basically, the camera work on the CB treats it like a character. Every time he's talking, you know, first of all, you only really know his voice.
Right.
Again, I think another flaw of the film is that you eventually get a face.
Yeah.
So, although it's not much of one, it's towards the end.
Well, I think that the only reason that that ended up happening is because you needed a physical person because it needed to come down to the hotel room.
Oh, you could have shot around it. I mean, I think without a doubt, you still could have shot around it. And even if it would have been like super artsy.
See, that's the thing is I think
I wanted it to shoot around it.
I didn't think the film wanted to hide the killer.
Yeah.
I think that they are just like, you know, this is a person, like that's the goal here. And had you not seen the face, it would have like gone to, I just didn't think, my guess is that the film didn't want to portray this as some like abstract, totally fucked up, supernatural-esque super killer. Just like a trucker that the wrong trucker to have pissed off.
And in the one of the 15 endings they actually chose for this film, if you have the DVD, there's what, 5 alternate endings on it?
There's 4 alternate endings and then the actual one they use in the film.
And a storyboard?
The storyboard's one of the 4.
So yeah, there's 5 total. But the one they choose and a mixed amount of the alternate endings basically give you the, oh, he's just some trucker guy. And there's sort of a bit of a twisty reveal in there that I don't like with the ice truck thing. But they give you that, it's just a guy. And so I think you're right on that. They wanted to make it, this is a person, this is a face.
Yeah.
Stylistically, you know, I
mean,
still
I just,
would have made the other choice.
I think that the goal, not the goal, but I think that a really good technique that they could have borrowed from, say, 7 is once they showed him, been like, oh my God, it's somebody I know, but not somebody I know from the film.
Right, exactly.
You know what I mean?
It's not like, oh, Kevin Spacey's been working in the department for 15 years.
Well,
no,
yeah,
he's just,
and it's not like Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman turn around and go, Kevin Spacey, you're the killer?
Yeah, right, exactly. He's just some guy. And while it's kind of an actor reveal, it's like, oh, hey, this is going to be good because Kevin Spacey's cool. Or at least back when 7 was made.
Yeah.
Where Joyride kind of lost me is when the camp is kind of introduced. You have a few moments that are, honestly, they're a little over the top cheesy. I think that begins, especially, I think a bad placement of that is after the first hotel scene, which is one of the most artistic shots in the whole film. Especially again, like we talked about with the tension, just to go back to that, you know, you zoom into this painting and the frame is just, it's all you're seeing is a painting and hearing muffled noise. You're kind of expecting a scare shot. You feel tense. You don't know what's going to happen. And the very next scene is bright outside and you have a corny sort of
Southern cop.
Yeah. You have a Southern cop, you know, chewing on a toothpick,
talking
and giving
funny,
sass and
doing
the
George W. Silly making up words thing.
Yeah. Right. And it's so unnecessary. And that's when the film first delves into this camp that it doesn't really lose. You still have interesting choices throughout. Directly at the gas station. Right after that, you have kind of the introduction to industrial elements into the score, which although they're very, very subtle, it's still a pretty typical horror score.
Yeah.
You do get a lot of like, well, it's sparing use of like thicker guitars or like, again, kind of industrial banging or clinks.
Yeah.
Little touches like that kind of kept me going through the film, but then they reintroduced these sort of campy shots again, naked cheeseburgers, for instance, that I just like, it just seems so unnecessary for me. It was kind of a comic relief moment that I thought was out of the realm of this film.
The conversation that follows that scene with Venna in the car kind of tries to rectify it.
Yeah.
But I think it seemed like it was written to rectify it after the fact.
Sure.
It seemed like J.J. Abrams, who wrote the film with another person whose name I can't remember.
Clay Tarver.
Maybe he like wrote, he's like, okay, well, we should do a naked scene. Or maybe the other person was like, maybe we should do a naked scene. And J.J. Abrams was like, okay, but then like, let's have him talk about how they must feel now, how he felt then. And they're like, okay, well, So that's a yes to the naked scene?
Well, I think one of the best things about that conversation that she has on the CB is when he's talking to her and she's basically trying to kind of empathize with right. what he's going through. And he makes that point that, you know, how do they feel to be at the receiving end of the joke? And he uses the line, he's talking about being in the rain holding his bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about it from Venice's perspective, she doesn't really know. She's sort of new to this.
Yeah.
You know, this is another weird thing the film kind of does that I really like is they introduce sort of a new character halfway through the film.
Right.
Who's
well, they introduce a character to the situation after the situation's already blown beyond like.
Yeah, for sure. Which is a strange technique that's kind of used later in Lost is a perfect kind of comparison for this, where it's a serialized show that's been going on a long time. So when you need to bring new viewers in, you introduce new characters. You explain old situations to the new characters and thusly to the new audience.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason to do that in this film, but you still have that same kind of device where the new character comes on, but for different reasons.
Right.
And I think you see another kind of J.J. Abrams element here that was sort of, you can tell this is his early work that he's improved upon this because you get a line like that in The Rain Holding My Bottle, which is an enigma to Venna, but not to the audience.
Right.
In later J.J. Abrams stuff, you get sort of the opposite of that. Cloverfield and again Lost does this a lot. You have pieces of a conversation that are sort of like puzzle pieces that aren't already fit together for you. You could have redone this. If this film would have been done in a modern day J.J. Abrams style, you would be delivered a scene like that at the beginning. Or maybe you would pick up the story with Venna.
Right.
And you would be given that line, which to you would be enigmatic. You would go, well, what is he talking about being in the rain with his bottle, which is kind of a mysterious line. And later you would piece it together to make sense.
Yeah.
And I think once he kind of mixes up those puzzle pieces, he creates a story that carries its weight a lot more, I think.
Another thing that I don't know how you feel about it, but another thing that I really thought that the film did that most horror movies do poorly is the scene with the ice truck driver.
Right.
Because like they do the thing that I would say 90% of horror films do,
right,
where they throw you the, you know, this isn't the killer.
It's a similar device to when we talked in Hostel about the meat cart.
Yeah.
That's come back several times.
Right.
Where, and this movie had a few of those scenes too, where they're shot from such an angle or cut in a weird time lapsed or time altered way. Specifically the scenes towards the end where
the
they're going
rooms.
To the hotel room and you think it's going to be her hotel room and it's not. And you think it's going to be hers and it's not. We call that the meat cart from a scene from Hostel where you think the character is going to get captured and, oh, he's in a meat cart. I would view the ice truck thing, and we can just call this the ice truck thing and it pulling an ice truck future podcasts where you think it's the killer, but it's not.
Right.
I would put that in the same place as scare shots.
Yeah.
It's a device that I just don't need. It's a take or leave kind of thing.
Well, here's the thing about this film doing it is, I think it's a device that they use for two reasons.
Mm-hmm.
One, I think it's to show how fucking scared these two guys are.
Yeah.
Because this guy, I mean, from a completely objective standpoint, that guy has done nothing to make you believe he's the killer.
Right.
He has a pressure checker and he's driving a truck.
The ice truck guy, you mean, yeah.
And you're like, but they're like, no, that's him. That's got to be him.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, because no pun intended, you're along for the ride with them.
Yeah.
You've got to just assume or at least play along.
Well, this is why I think it's a bad mechanic because you are playing along. First of all, I mean, they've really built this guy up as sort of a mystery. And when you see, you know, they shoot him in a way where he's still mysterious, but he's less mysterious once they get to the gas station. He's driving a truck, which I thought was pretty obvious that it was a different truck.
Because it was tiny.
Yeah, maybe,
yeah,
maybe
see,
not.
You think you see the tiny truck and you're like, that can't be it.
Also, you're a half hour into the film, so I'm just not buying it. And that's the problem with any of these scenes. People have watches at home.
Yeah.
They know when the movie's not over. And when you're bringing a killer who has been, you know, the CB radio mechanic, which they set up really well, and I think most audience members know that they're going to continue to use, I think you take a step back and you kind of underestimate the intelligence of your audience when you use a scene like this.
Here's the other thing. I said they did it for two reasons.
Sure.
And here's the other reason. Which I'm actually going to divide into two parts because I should have thrown in a third buffer.
Great.
But reason 2A is they needed a device to get them away from the gas station and somewhere where they couldn't get away easily, which is running from somebody who's not chasing them.
Yeah.
2B is probably essentially just for the fucking scene where the truck drives through the ice truck and you get this, like... In a film like this, you want to reveal the villain, let's say, in a way that is, you want a reveal of a villain that's equivalent to how scary the villain is.
Yeah.
You can do one way or the other. You can take The Hitcher, for example, where you pick up the villain on the side of the road and you don't even realize he's a bad guy.
Yeah.
And then you just kind of go through the film realizing how bad of a guy he is.
Sure.
Or you could take the Joyride approach where you go, whoo, that guy was kind of scary.
Right.
And then this guy blows him up.
Right,
by driving through him.
Yeah,
and then you've just got a full-on Mack truck driving at you at full speed.
At the end of the day, I think what we have here is, it's a device, and I don't to see my devices in film. Sometimes there's a ticking time bomb plot device, and you take it or leave it. That's the choice you're offered there. You took it, I left it, and that's kind of just what happens
here.
The ending of this film I want to get back to, because the ending we actually get doesn't involve Charlotte.
Right.
Charlotte, I think of all the things that this film does unsuccessfully, and I'm picking on this film because it's J.J. Abrams and he's improved so vastly since this.
Right.
That to compare his most recent work to
second most recent work.
Well, yeah. It just seems to be, you know, it's absurd.
Uh-huh.
So you really do. And again, you have films like The Hitcher that have taken this specific on the run horror kind of genre and just improved upon it exponentially. I don't think this is a bad film, but again, that's why I'm being overcritical of it. The thing I have to be the most critical of is the jumble of confused, I don't know what we're going to go with endings, which could be any combination of studio, test, reaction, whatever. When you have the budget and you shoot all these alternate endings, what's going to happen is plot elements are going to get cut up and you're going to try and reassemble your story in post.
Exactly.
It works fairly well here once you see all the footage they have for all these endings and how, you know, the poor editor's job to like put this story together. The thing that does not carry over well at all is Charlotte.
The reason that the Charlotte problem exists is because in the original ending, Charlotte is solely a device used to get them to agree to go to a certain location.
Right.
Which in the original ending, they have an encounter with Rusty Nail, blah, blah. Charlotte gets found later in a train yard with the then ice truck guy.
Uh-huh.
And Charlotte's okay. And then she's out of the story. And there's still 25 minutes left to film. And the whole Charlotte device takes maybe 10 minutes.
Yeah.
The problem with the ending they went with, as far as Charlotte goes, is that they needed her for the device to get her to get them to this specific location, but then they don't need her anymore.
Right.
So they kind of just put her on the hush hush until the very end when you look in the truck and she's crying in the back and you're like, oh yeah, I forgot about her.
Which once you get to the ending, which I think is already bad, you have this Charlotte plot thread, which I think makes it even worse. The thing that this ending does wrong, and again, I think more recent films have understood what audiences are kind of expecting or even want. You need some brutality in this ending. This ending is way too clean for me. You have the male lead gets away fine. You have his brother totally okay, except for Spike through his leg. Girlfriend totally doing fine. And, you know, that would have been bad enough there. But then you have Charlotte, who it turns out is a character you don't even care about.
Yeah, right.
Which in the back of your mind, you're like, oh, well, at least there's somebody coming.
Uh-huh.
And even Charlotte's okay.
Right.
It's like when the dog runs up in the end of the movie and jumps in your arms and you're like, oh, Fido is okay as well.
Yeah.
Look, the whole family's
like
together.
We mentioned earlier in the show, so this is perfect, but the studio wouldn't let us have a downer ending. So we had to bring him back. Hell, why we're at it, why don't we bring everybody back? And then everybody starts walking Abraham Lincoln and Elvis.
You know, when you have a dynamic story with dynamic characters, there needs to be repercussions to people's actions.
Mm-hmm.
And while they're, you know, that's the thing about a dramatic film like this, is something, you know, theatrical, is that they made a prank phone call and in the end, one or two or all of them needs to die as a result.
Right.
And they're totally uneven, you know, it's the kind of moral of the story fairy tale that's so ridiculous, but that's how it needs to be.
Yeah.
You know, these guys played a prank and of course they don't deserve to die for it. But in a horror film like that, that's sort of the twisted moral of the story. So we're going to turn to, again, a nonsensical pair up for this movie.
Fantastic.
Which is the Attic Expeditions.
Awesome.
You know, it's funny, we talked to Mike Wilson about this last week, but a lot of times it's hard to have an honest discussion about a film and a discussion that's therefore inclusive of a film's flaws when the very director is nice enough to agree to come on your show. And I don't think that's ever going to be more true than Jeremy Kasten. This is a guy who's a horror enthusiast who we really identify with and who's a supporter of what we're doing with our show. Having said that, we are going to try our goddamn best. This isn't going to be the same conversation as Joyride. Jeremy Kasten's also done The Thirst. He did All Souls Day with Danny Trejo and a movie I haven't seen yet, The Wizard of Gore, which I know you're really into.
Mm-hmm.
But The Attic Expeditions was his first film and it takes a lot of risks. And we'll talk about that stuff a little bit on the show, but I hope to really talk about it in our interview.
Right.
I thought the most natural place to start this discussion would be with why I own the film, and that is Crazy People. We talked about this a little bit back when we did 12 Monkeys, which was our like first fucking episode.
Yeah.
But I know you're not as into it.
Yeah.
I love crazy people in film.
I don't know why.
Okay. So I'm gonna give you my reason why. Because I didn't really even think about it until today. And I was like, you know, if we're going to have the crazy people talk again, I want to kind of like go over why. So, and this is a perfect example of that. As a model, let's just use the scene with the foosball table.
The foosball table.
Yeah, where they're sitting in the recreational room, Seth Green and Trevor, Douglas and Trevor.
Douglas.
And they're kind of circling the foosball table. Seth Green's character is going on and on about kind of two different things, which is what crazy people usually sort of explore in film. Postmodernism, to some extent, and this kind of paranoid philosophy, almost bordering on conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
He touches both of those in really in kind of a big way. He's talking about how much of paranoia is a healthy dose and when do you cross the line, which is, again, kind of a conspiracy thing. I think those kind of go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the postmodernism thing, a lot of that, like, are we even here? Does it matter if we're here? Is this in your head? Is it an afterthought? This may confuse you because both of those are ideas that I find laughable.
Yeah.
Conspiracies,
right.
And postmodernism. You can see those executed in two ways on film. You know, conversation-wise, you can see them executed by crazy people and you can see them executed by druggies.
Mm-hmm.
When people get really high, they start talking about postmodernism. And those are ideas I like to see portrayed on film. One, because they're amusing to me, because I find them kind of laughable.
Right.
But even if they're, you know, even if it's relevant as an idea for discussion, because it's a philosophical argument, you know, it's something that can be talked about in some kind of a rational context. And I can't see it addressed on film by druggies because I have this idea that when you're under the influence of a drug, you don't think straight and you don't present a rational argument.
Mm-hmm.
So I like seeing crazy people opening their horizons of thought on film. I enjoy that.
While we're on the subject of crazy people, and since we got to do a J.J. Abrams thing earlier, the execution of insanity in Fringe is like jaw-dropping.
Really?
Yeah, because it's not like...
This is something I still haven't gotten around to, so I'll have to check that out.
It's not like tweaky, like, whoa, they're out to get you, or...
Right.
Sorry, that was a druggie right. Doing the whoa, they're out to get you, but regardless...
See, I can do the Seth Green really well, and maybe this is another thing with the crazy people, because when I saw this film, it's almost like we talked about in the first Hostel podcast, where I see so much myself in the character, it almost disturbs me a little bit. So, you know, they introduce this character and you're watching this character and he kind of fits into a certain mold. He's the crazy person. But every once in a while, he'll say something like talking about an idea and how that gives it power and like a will of its own. And I'm pretty sure I've spoken those exact same words verbatim. And something about that like makes my skin crawl. I'm like, it's a character that I don't identify with echoing something that I've actually said. And something about that in film, it makes me really intrigued and I have to watch it.
All right. Well, that's totally understandable.
You would say, you know, even for somebody who doesn't like crazy people as much as I do, that Seth Green is awesome in this, right? I mean, he's a lot of fun to watch.
The cast of this film, for as independent as it looked, as independent as I'm guessing it was, or at least low budget is probably a better term to use there.
Yeah, for sure.
Everybody was solid, but Trevor, like... My film going experience was consistently disrupted by the actor playing Trevor.
Yeah.
He was so bad.
I don't know that my opinion of him is as bad as yours. Part of what made his acting look a lot worse than the people, you know, he was working with was that he had to carry the bulk of the movie.
Well, but see, here's the thing is I think that that's something that any actor could have done, because given the script to this film and then being told you're the lead role, all you have to do is act as confused as you already are.
Keanu Reeves in The Matrix.
Like you have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
The script doesn't tell you shit.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you want to maybe elaborate on where the story goes.
Well, we'll get to that while you're talking about the actors. So another thing I really like about this film, it takes a lot of chances. The film does a lot of really experimental things, most of which I think probably don't work. But I like to see that, especially in a first-time filmmaker, to not make a safe film. You know, this is a film that I find more interesting than most of the films I'll see all year, just because it decides it's going to do really weird things. And seeing that kind of creativity, whether it fails or not, if I look at it as experimental, I really enjoy that. I'll just pass over the reoccurring stuff. You know, you have the inverted color, quick flashes, and, you know, all that kind of like gimmicky overused stuff, frankly. But you have specific scenes, especially any of the sex scenes. Right from the beginning, there's Amy's 90s metal sex scene in her room.
Yeah.
Where they're showing like all the drawings intermixed with them fucking.
Yeah.
Which is a really bizarre choice of how they set that up. Especially that portrayal of sex in such a like quirky, awkward fashion. When there's nothing, you know, if you want to look at awkward sex on film, I think A History of Violence does that better than ever. But this is sex that's totally normal, enjoyable, two kids going at it, great. But the way they shoot it and the things they choose to focus on, how bizarre the environment is, I think that works for what it's doing. And you go right from that to probably what I would say is the most risky shot of the whole film, which is the heavy metal cartoon blood vision he has, where he like looks in the mirror and he sees himself with basically in surgery with the top part of his head removed. This would already be a weird scene, but do you remember the cartoon blood?
Yeah.
That slowly what's up with that?
I don't know, but like that's the kind of thing that Natural Born Killers did like pretty much through the whole film. Stuff like that. And I like that. Doing shit that like shows that there's really something wrong with whatever's going on is a good way to go. But I don't think it's something that you throw in the middle of a film where everything else is like...
Well, the tone of the film is a little too serious to pull those scenes off.
Yeah, it's just like...
That contrast is where the experiments kind of fail.
By comparison, everything is really placid to the shot of screaming and running and the fucking golden eye blood.
Another one of these scenes, I think the one that worked the most successfully and one of my favorite shots in the film is when he's kind of in the ghost town.
Uh-huh.
The one that uses the same song from a more recent film, Funny Games, which is the weird like metal screaming, almost tribalistic kind of track.
Yeah.
Sort of reminds me of the like futuristic music from Children of Men when they're in their car.
Yeah.
Or the, I'm sorry.
The Zen not the, music.
Yeah. The Zen.
In, yeah.
Right. Which is also used as their alarm. And I forgot that I just recently saw Funny Games and I forgot that was in this as well.
Yeah.
So they have kind of this deserted ghost town with this weird 3D rendering of clouds, which I could take or leave because it's CGI and it doesn't look very good. But then you also have the flickering like white lights in all the windows and then the strange like white ghost people coming out, the dead thing in the road. It's just so bizarre. And for some reason, like I'm prepared for bizarre by that point because it's late in the film. And I like that scene. The height of ridiculousness.
Oh, there's a height?
In this film. I want to see if you would agree with me or not. I think as far as experimental or bizarre scenes, and we got to talk about this because it's a montage, and I would also say it is the single most ridiculous montage in any film we've ever seen, is the delusional witchcraft intercourse montage.
Yeah.
You know which one I'm talking about?
I know very well what you're talking about.
So this film, I'll also give it credit because it has like full-on intercourse, pornographic intercourse. Shot in a way that really, I mean, it still looks kind of artsy.
Or silly because they're on a spinning desk.
Well, yeah. It's silly and artsy. Or maybe one because of the other. But I mean, this is like no holds barred. This isn't like a Desperado montage. Yeah. I mean, this is just like people are having sex and we're going to put a camera on a 360 rig and just shoot that. But it's also cut in with all these weird head trip moments of the film and the strange music. And it just makes for one of the most bizarre. And I can't remember a montage as weird as this ever.
I can't
in
either.
Anything. So congratulations, Attic Expeditions, for winning the Weirdest Montage of All Time award.
So far. So after watching this film and after watching Joyride, which is... Joyride does this thing that some films do where you know what's going on.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna put all the pressure on you to explain to not only me, but every single listener who's ever seen this.
So I have to give credit to my ex-girlfriend Chrissy, who does not listen to this show, I'm assuming, for showing me this film. And I'm pretty sure
credit.
It took her a while to get me to watch it, but I did. And we had a really long discussion when I first saw it about what the fuck is going on in this movie. Of course, we reached no conclusion, right? I kept the movie and I've shown it to other people, and this is maybe my fifth or sixth time watching it, and I'm still struggling to get what's going on. So here on the show for the final time, I'm going to try and understand this movie and then I give up.
All right.
So let's just do this chronologically, because I'm going to say straight away that, you know, if you're listening to this, you probably also have no idea what's going on. We're going to watch a film probably in a couple episodes called Primer, which is a film that I know looking at it, you can figure out what's going on. I trust the guy who wrote it. And we're going to try the same method again with that. But this is a film that I'm not sure if the people who made it have a coherent vision of what happened. So the problem with figuring this out, the biggest problem, after seeing it a couple times, I could come away with storylines from this or pieces of plot. I could basically explain this movie to you using several different kinds of story. It could be any one of a number of things. I would be able to pick one of those things if we could play a game where I get to remove, say, two scenes. I could take out two different scenes in a variety of ways and then make a coherent film. Because all the scenes are in there and I can't take them out, I'm going to have to try and formulate just one good solid plot in this. And what makes that the hardest to do, and I think the fault of the film, is when you have a story and then you're trying to mix it up as puzzle pieces, which is one of my favorite kinds of film. Mm-hmm. We've talked about that with films like Memento.
Yeah, I was going to say Memento.
Where there's a solid story in there and you jigsaw it a little bit. And Memento lays out how the jigsaw works.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you a very clear path of how to assemble the pieces, which is something not a lot of films of that nature do. This is a film that mixes up the pieces just in writing and in story, but then in chronology also mixes up the pieces, probably. Here's one of the problems, right? Is you don't know if this story is told in a linear fashion or not. What makes that really hard is you're given repeated scenes. Most notably, I would say the scene at the end, which echoes the beginning, where he's like in bed and they're having the exact same verbatim dialogue with, oh, he's not going to wake up. So you're thinking, well, that's at the beginning. So are we seeing like a circular loop here? Right. Are we just revisiting the beginning? Is the beginning of this film the physical beginning of the film, you know, so many minutes into it? Is that also the chronological end of the film? We don't know. The other problem, and that's enough to wrap your head around, is...
Well, it's different the second time because he doesn't get up.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah, but I mean, it's different, but that's the only thing it's literally like the delivering of the lines by the two women.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's verbatim the same. Which brings us into the territory of hallucination, which also makes films like this really hard to deal with. The other point about chronology that makes this hard is that you get him knocking on in the attic, which is also him underneath. And so he's pulling himself into his own treasure chest in the attic. And that creates another like path of... circularity, if you will, that
I won't, but I'll pretend
really,
you can.
Really hard to understand.
So you said earlier that there were two, if you could take any two scenes out of the film to make it more coherent, I'm assuming it would be the one where he's still sleeping and the one where he pulls himself into the chest.
Either of those, I think. In fact, you could remove either one of those scenes and I think get a more solid story. The other thing I think you could probably do is, if you did away with a lot of the operation scenes where they're working on his brain, I think that would make it a little bit easier for me. The big gap in time, I think, is probably a clue. But when I start working on it in my head, it's like playing that Xbox game Braid, and you're dealing with time paradoxes, and your mind explodes.
Eventually, it comes out that it's not 2004.
Right.
Okay.
So let's try and deal with this chronologically and see if we can do it. The first thing that could be happening is he could be playing an ARG, right? I mean, that's possible. And then movie's over. Also, he could be hallucinating. If he's hallucinating, that's the thing I think of all the things, I would take that off the table, because once you get into the environment where you have an unreliable narrator, which is one of my favorite gimmicks in film, it's been done in so many classic films. I think when it's done right, I really like it. Mm-hmm. But when you add that, when you add unreliable narrator to nonlinear story, and also, you know, acid trip, and we have actors who are playing characters who are playing actors, you have so many layers that it becomes almost indecipherable. To move linearly through the story, we have him waking up. He talks to Dr. Eck, and then they bring him to the House of Love. Now, I think his hairstyles are probably the best way to pick up chronologically what goes where, mm-hmm. but it's still going to be really difficult. So let's deal with everything when he's at the house. So when he's at the house, he has recollections of when he was with Faith and when this ceremony happened and when they had the book. Going through the House of Love, you start getting these clues that things aren't as they seem. And basically what it comes down to is the people at the House of Love are actors. Okay, so that sounds pretty encapsulated, right? I think we could both agree that that's what's going on there. Mm-hmm. However, this time, I noticed going through it, you have the scene with the guy with the puppet hand. Now, if he is an actor playing a character, there's no reason for him to be the first one to explain to Trevor that there's weird things going on in the house. Because he's sort of breaking character, but in a way where if he's breaking character, then the actor is delusional because he's talking to his hand puppet, mm-hmm. which I also think is a good strength of the film in that they filmed the hand puppet as if it's another character. Mm-hmm. It really kind of makes you believe that delusion. Aside from an unreliable narrator, the characters are pretty unreliable too, because you don't know if they're crazy or acting. They're mm-hmm. Let's go with their acting, right? Because right. that seems to be where the film wants us to go.
Yeah, which I thought was dumb because that seems like such a simple answer and it the rest really of the is. Film is too complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is what makes me not buy into it, but that seems to be where the plot goes when they send people in. And, you know, in retrospect, they're looking at the monitors this whole time to see how things are going in the house. Mm-hmm. So I think even the puppet confession is part of Eck's master plan to get the book back from Trevor.
Right.
So I'm going to go with actors. Okay. So we have that piece solved. We have, he goes into the house, he has sex with Amy. Amy's an actor who kind of fell for him. Then he leaves the house. All mm-hmm. right. So we've got that figured out. Now the motivation of why is he in the house becomes probably one of the trickiest pieces. Dr. X says early on when he's talking to Ted Raimi, actually, who's pretty good in this film. I like Ted Raimi, that he's trying to solve every mental illness ever. That's his goal here. Ted Raimi doesn't understand what's at stake here, but it looks like he's also trying to find the book. I'm going to cheat here and say that finding the book solves all mental illness ever, right? Because he's either lying to Ted Raimi's character when he says he's trying to solve all mental illness, or he has two separate goals, or finding the book is what will make him solve all mental illness. Any one of those is fine, but let's simplify things here. Let's try and apply Occam's razor to this, if that's even possible. Mm-hmm. And let's say he wants to find the book and as a byproduct, maybe solve all mental illness. Although at the end, it kind of looks like he has greedy goals yeah. and he just wants to rule the world. But okay, let's just take that in. So what he does is he sends Trevor back to this house, which is Trevor's house, where they conducted the ritual and Trevor hid the book.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay? Can we go there?
Yeah.
You don't see any holes with that so far?
No. Well, I have no idea. The book, like,
this is an alternate universe where supernatural things exist and there's witchcraft.
Uh-huh.
So here is my final summation of the story. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to go with he and Faith were a happy couple. They decided to get a house. In the house, they found a book that only Trevor could read because he had a magic power. He had some supernatural
with
power.
With a K.
Right. It's magic with a K, which is one of my favorite scenes in this because it's so absurd. It just reminds me of being in middle school yeah. and every girl I knew. Okay. So he finds the book, only he can read the book. He tries to teach Faith things about the book and they start participating in these ceremonies, the end goal of which is to merge both of their bodies. Something goes awry in the ceremony and he kills Faith. As a result of that, they put him in this home for the criminally insane. He becomes under Dr. X's care. Dr. Uh-huh. X learns about the book through whatever means, and he wants it. He wants to get this book. So he puts Trevor in the house. The goal of Trevor being in his, what was his own house, is to find the book hidden in there, which is hidden under the last stair of the staircase, which you can get to by going into the attic and crawling through the stairs. Meanwhile, the spirit of his dead ex-girlfriend, I assume ex-girlfriend, because after you kill your girlfriend, she becomes your ex-girlfriend, right?
Not in this movie, because ex-girlfriend would be whoever was dating Dr. Eck.
So she's also trying to get the book. She later possesses Seth Green's character, which is when things get really weird. The second time they send Trevor to the house because Dr. Eck is not quite getting the results he wants.
Uh-huh.
He tries to drug up Trevor and see if he can find in somewhere in Trevor's hallucination will reveal where he's getting the book, but that doesn't work. The fact that we've accepted the supernatural, by the way, also explains all the weird stuff with the matches and the lights going out. So I'm just going to accept that too.
Except Dr. Eck can do it.
Yeah, which is weird because maybe he dabbles in magic, which is how he knows about the book. We don't know how
and
he knows about
the book.
Maybe
he can read it because they can both light matches.
Sure. Got it. Thank you.
Maybe that's why he wants the book. Because if he had the book, then like Trevor, he can be the super ultimate powerful being with the redheaded girlfriend.
So he kills Seth Green, who is Faith, putting her out of the picture. Upon a final exploration of what is in the attic, he gets pulled in by his former self, which is, fuck, I was so close.
Yeah.
That's it. I lost it right there.
It's gone.
That gets into a time travel paradox because it's earlier in the chronology of things. Yeah. I don't want to add a time travel paradox to this. So I'm going to say that him knocking on the chest exists infinitely throughout time because the next scene we see is him sleeping.
Yeah.
In a coma-like state, right? Which again has to exist infinitely throughout time because it introduces a time paradox in that it's the first part we saw in the movie.
Unless he's just been dreaming the whole time.
I'm going to eliminate that and I'm going to opt for, this is like constructing my own film here somehow, just by figuring out what's going on. I'm going to go with, they introduce the final chronological piece of the movie at the beginning of the movie.
Okay.
Or that he's perpetually stuck in a coma and this is what's going on in his head, which seems like a cheat because I could have just said that one sentence at the beginning.
Yeah.
So that's it. That's my final summation of what's happening in this film.
All right.
So to help us sort through a lot of this, we actually have Jeremy Kasten, who directed The Attic Expeditions. Jeremy, I really want to thank you for coming on the show today.
Absolutely. It's great to be here.
So you've been doing editing for a long time before directing this. This was your first film to direct. So what brought you to this project? How did this all come together?
Attic Expeditions was a movie born originally to be a film called Witchcraft 4. When I was in the middle of film school in Boston, I came out to Los Angeles for a summer and the following fall semester and realized that my destiny, I mean, I always knew I wanted to make horror movies. At the time, I still thought I might end up being an East Coast filmmaker, and I didn't really realize how much Los Angeles would suit me.
Right.
And how it's not the city that I'd seen in movies and wasn't like lame Beverly Hills, but was, you know, the Los Angeles Bukowski lore and film noir and all the good things about LA, plus like movies everywhere. And I came out and I went from being like a PA to an editor and associate producer on feature films just in a summer. And it was still like, you know, $50,000 movies or whatever, but still, it was a glorified PA, but with the producer credit. And the writer for Witchcraft 4, which was this, you know, terrible fourth in the series where Julie Strain and a couple other people were attached to be in this, you know, piece of shit, $60,000, 16mm movie for Academy Entertainment, if anybody remembers them, and Vista Street Entertainment was the production company. The writer was late with the script. And I called, at the time, my writing partner who lived in Mississippi, and I was like, look, man, just go out and get a ton of drugs, go home and get a script in the next couple days. Whatever you want, just watch the first three witchcraft movies and write something that's kind of like it, but, you know, low budget, write something cool, and I'll give it to him.
Right.
And he wrote it in 5 days on a drug-fueled binge and sent it to me, Federal Express, within 5 days, no joke. And I read it on my way to work in the car. And, you know, pulled over and was like, there's no fucking way I'm going to give them this script. I want to make a movie. And so I sat on it and, you know, Witchcraft 4 was a piece of shit. And right after we finished, I gave the script to the guy who financed that movie. And I was like, hey, this is the movie I'd like to make for you. Maybe it can be Witchcraft 5, but I want to direct it. And he read it and he loved it, and he set me to working with a producer to bring it together. She budgeted it out, and we were like talking about it. And Joe was 19 years old, thinking, "Fuck, I'm gonna be a movie director. I'm gonna make The Attic Expedition."
Oh shit! So you were 19 when you did this?
Oh yeah,
that's fantastic.
Well, not when I made the movie. This is the story of how it came to me. Mm-hmm. I was 26 when I directed Attic. The wheels had been set in motion. I'm working with the producer. I think this is all going to go great.
Yeah.
And then this like completely, you know, insane low budget producer is like, you know, as we're starting to budget the movie and work it out, you know, Witchcraft 5: The Attic Expeditions or whatever.
Yeah.
Dude then sits me down and he's like, all right. So I looked at it again and I think this is going to work fine. We got to get rid of the attic and this whole house thing. Maybe the movie could take place in an airplane.
Wow.
And at that point, I was like, fuck.
Wow.
People are insane. And that's why that was like my first real experience with, you know, what often happens in Los Angeles. Oh, you think you're making a movie and you think you're moving along. And then you spent the last 6 months, you know.
Where he's basically like, hey, this is great, except all of the content in the script. We just need to get rid of that.
Yeah. Totally. I love the sex scenes, kid. But just take it on an airplane. I got access to an airplane set out in the valley.
Wow. What? So how did this come to the form that we see it?
Well, as you said, I had started to, you know, after school, I came back out here and I continued on the trajectory of editing. Was cutting feature films and working for like low budget genre companies, editing their low budget genre movies and, you know, whatever, Fat Beach and Legion of the Night. And
right.
These films that I was looking around going, fuck, man, people were figuring out how to raise $100,000 and making crappy movies. If I could just raise a little bit of money, I could at least try to make a good movie, which seemed to me to be better than what everybody else was doing, where they didn't even fucking care.
Right.
So my best friend and I, Dan Gold, who produced the movie with me, we set about to figure out how to raise money without, you know, any real background in that or any real clue as to how you do it. We just, you know, started figuring it out. It took us about maybe a year and a half from the time I remember coming home from work and sitting him down and being like, dude, I'm cutting a movie that a guy made for $30,000. There's no reason we shouldn't be shooting The Attic Expeditions in a year from now. And right. A year and a half later, you know, we were shooting. We shot it over 4 years.
Wow.
And you can kind of tell, like, Andras looks different in the hospital scenes. And, you know, people change. Seth Green came back to shoot, I think, the scenes in the attic were shot as part of the second shoot. It was like 3 or 4 shoots over about 3.5-4 years where we'd raise money. We shot most of The House of Love all at once and then we're running on air. Had you know, so the whole crew was free. The cast was working for $75 a day, which was the SAG minimum for an experimental film or a limited exhibition film at the time.
So, I mean, you landed a couple giants for this. I mean, you know, you got Ted Raimi on here, which is fantastic, but you attached Seth Green to the project too. I mean, did you see getting that kind of caliber of actors?
You know, at the time, Jeffrey Combs was the big brain.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We cast Jeffrey first. And he sort of, Wendy Roby, Ted Raimi, and Seth Green, and Andras Jones all came on the movie because they wanted to be in something that Jeff was in.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And he was like the guy who brought everybody else on. And Seth hadn't even done Buffy yet. He'd just done the first Austin Powers when he was cast in it. So his star, you know, he's a child actor who was just sort of making the transition into, you know, late teen actor or whatever, like where you know, he didn't quite have a following as that yet. So we got very, very lucky. He came onto the movie, you know, as something he was doing from the heart and for the passion of the role. It was really cool.
So you mentioned this being kind of an experimental film, and we talked about it when we did the full segment on the show, but this film does a lot of risky things. How much of it was just an experiment for you?
It's a good question. I wish I could put it in a smart context. You know what? I always wanted the movie to make sense and to work as a feature and not as an experimental film. I said experimental film in the sense that in order to be able to get to work with the Screen Actors Guild, with the Actors Union,
sure.
We had to call it experimental on some level. I think a lot of people try and slip under the radar by saying, oh, I'm making an experimental film. Whoopsie daisy, it went from being a 28-page script, it expanded into a feature film.
Right.
Attic has that weird kind of experimental vibe to it, but it the intention was always to make a movie that was heavily psychedelic and very drug influenced,
fueled,
but still was a feature film. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like not a kind of. I was thinking experimental films as films that don't work.
Sure.
In my heart of hearts, I'd like to think that Attic is an experiment that's successful, if not entirely. You know, I mean, it's certainly a little cryptic, and people sometimes have a hard time with it. But I'd like to think that all the answers are there to piece the puzzle together.
Is there anything that you really held back with, or really any of the idea? Was there anything basically that was too crazy?
There was so much shit I couldn't afford in the, you know, in the movie that I wanted to do. From, you know, there's that fish tank in the game room,
right.
And in the end, I think as written, Ronald, the guy with the puppet, his head was supposed to be. Oh no, it's the orderly, the first orderly. His head's supposed to be smashed into it by Douglas, by Seth Green's character, so the fish go pouring out and his face is all cut up. And really, we intended to do that right up until the end. The fish were going to, you know, unfortunately be killed, and it didn't work out that way. It was too unwieldy to pull off with the dummy. And I mean, there's got to be 50 other things like that in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly, I tried to shoot more movie than I needed, and there was a lot more exposition and a lot more explaining, a lot more monologues, and a lot more talking. It's still kind of a talky movie,
right.
But it was the only way to make it affordable. But I held back in editing it from having a lot of the characters explain what was going on at every particular time and try to figure out what the audience would hopefully be piecing together at any point so that it wasn't completely spoon-feeding them.
Right. So thinking back to some of the different shots and effects, particularly the animated blood that comes down in a couple of the scenes, was that a product of your budget or was that deliberate aesthetics?
At the time, okay, so picture a world in the mid to late 90s when we were finishing the movie where the ability to finish a movie digitally didn't exist.
Right.
But still, if you wanted to make a movie, you were reliant entirely just about on optical effects, old-fashioned optical printed effects.
True.
With like a handful of digital effects, which even then, like I remember the sequence where he's running down the street,
right.
And the street is all freaky and weird and noisy, and you know, which like is one of those sequences that I feel like almost works.
Right.
I remember coming up with that sequence, and we got this company, MVFX, Manix Digital Effects, won the Academy Award for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, to come on to do the Attic Expeditions, all the digital effects for free at a time where, like, and we got Kodak to do the scanning of the frames from the film. And at the time, that was, like, fucking unheard of.
Yeah.
Now, of course, even, you know, any movie I've made in the last few years, there's you really can do shit within the Avid or within Final Cut Pro and exterior programs like Shape or whatever, and have that just on a movie that shows up on video. At the time, that didn't exist. So the blood coming down looks like, you know, this very kind of hokey now, because
right.
I saw the movie for the first time this year in years, and I was like, oh, that's so cringy. And people bring it up, like, oh, what's up with that?
Yeah.
But at the time, it was like verging on, you know, still a sophisticated optical effect for a low-budget horror movie,
right.
that kept the, you know, in that dream sequence reality or whatever. So, like, a bunch of fast cuts, and it was like this sort of overarching effect that held that sequence together. Now, of course, it looks kind of goofy in the same way that you look at, what's the Ken Russell movie with William Hurt, where he's like the gorilla guy in the tank.
Legend of Sasquatch? Is that?
No, that's a great guess, but no, it's not Sasquatch.
That's the most I got for you.
Altered States, the Ken Russell film.
Okay.
It's a fucking phenomenal movie. It's
really
got to be Ken Russell's maybe, you know, greatest movie, if not, you know, among his greatest movies.
Oh, cool.
It's a really, really cool movie. And it's got and it was, you know, a big budget studio film for the most part. And it has these effects at the end that are so cringy and so don't work now. But at the time, they seemed, you know, completely cutting edge in, you know, 1970.
Right.
Or whatever. And you know, in another 10 years, you won't even see it that way anymore. It'll just be, oh, those are the effects from that movie. But it takes a while. You look at effects on movies now, sometimes from the 70s or whatever, and you're like, oh, that's so cringy. It looks like some crappy video toaster effect. But at the time, it was like, oh, wow, solarization, that's cool looking.
Yeah.
And hopefully in another 10 years, like that crappy dripping blood won't look, you know, quite the same cringy as it does now.
Right.
With a little more history behind it, I'll be like, oh yeah, that's very much of the period. Right now it looks totally crazy.
Maybe it'll come back. Maybe it'll be like a retro thing.
That's what I'm hoping. It wasn't intended to be cheesy, I think, to answer your question. Hopefully, to answer your question.
Do you think filmmakers have a responsibility to make things that are going to withstand the test of time?
I hope you try. I mean, I always try.
Yeah.
But you can't ever know what the things are going to be that are going to be, you know, Attic has that fucking music in it. Not the score. I love the score, but there's music on that movie that you know, the producers, who are my best friends, at the time everybody was doing soundtrack deals.
Right.
That was like the big thing in the late 90s. Like, well, you know, we really might get a soundtrack deal, but you have to put some pop music on it. And I was like, you guys, this movie just shouldn't have any pop music. And they forced it on there. Every time it happens in the movie, it makes me cringe and makes me know I should have fought a little bit harder against it. But, you know, you don't know really at the time. You don't know that's going to be the shit that's... I did, actually, in that case.
Right.
I was like, that's going to totally fuck this movie up.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, watching the movie over again every time I revisit it, the music is actually one of the things I kind of forget about. And when it pops back up, I got to say, I really like it.
The score or the song?
No, the actual songs in it. I mean, you have like Bonehead, which was featured prominently in the remake of Funny Games more recently.
Right.
You know, just different finds like that. And the music is just so absolute. It's because it almost doesn't fit. It's just absolutely insane.
Yeah.
And I think it just adds to kind of the madness of stuff. I wanted to ask you, actually, since you brought up the songs, you have that montage scene with, I think it's a Hay song, Chant.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's one of the weirdest things we've ever, hands down, weirdest montage we've ever talked about on this show. And man, do we talk about montages. But you have Faith and Trevor fucking, you have flashbacks of them getting the house and Trevor's finding the chest and all this weird witchcraft stuff is going on. I mean, where did this montage come from?
It's supposed to set up the backstory of his life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he lived with Faith in the house before he killed her and what happens. And hopefully give, you know, the audience the pieces to put it together. You know, honestly, when you really look at that movie and the shit it hinges on, it is such a preposterous set of circumstances.
Right.
Isn't that, you know, that's always the way.
Same
with, you know, any great, you know, Evil Dead 2 hinges on a preposterous set of circumstances.
Right.
It's just that these are, like, particularly involved, you know. He's a black magician that moved to a house and finds a book under the stairs, and that's how he gets into black magic. It's never quite clear.
Right.
Then it turns out she can actually read the book, even though he never thought she could. And she is learning black magic too, so he has to kill her. Like, what the fuck? Then there's another guy who decides that he's going to get him to reveal where the book is by creating a giant experiment around him.
But, right.
You know, whatever. That's, you know, that's at the core of the movie. It's still, I think, a fun ride.
Right.
But yeah, the function of that montage essentially is to get that information across.
I think the function totally comes across. I mean, that's exactly what I absorbed from it. But it's such a weird deliverance. I mean, I'm wondering, you know, as I'm watching this and all this crazy shit is going on, is that something that originally came out of, you know, the drug-induced script? Was that your direction style? Did you go, hey, we need to tell this part of the story? Let's make it as insanely climactic as possible. I mean, why did
the truth is that drug-induced script had elements that we kept, but lots of stuff that we didn't.
All right.
And the trunk and the kind of house of love and a few of those things were there. Dr. Eck didn't exist. You know, I think Douglas was barely a character. Like there were ideas there that got developed over, you know, the next 5 years with me working really closely with Rogan Marshall. And you know, I think he did a great job, but there was a lot of stuff that I was really hung up on. The idea that Trevor needed a goal, you know, to get home and
right.
and that whole idea of them being actors that came out of later drafts. And certainly some of that really, like, you have to give the audience a context stuff, like the montages, that's definitely me shit, mm-hmm. where I'm like, well, they can end up with sex, but also, you know, show them fucking, and also, let's show their life together, let's show them buying the house, and, you know, crap like that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm sure that's coming from me.
Just in preparation of the show, we spent a lot of time, like, kind of looking around and trying to get different people's takes on the story, and you don't find, I think it's because really the film came out before the age of the internet, but you really don't find a whole lot of people discussing the film. And in looking up different information about it, I found something that just blew my mind. On the Wikipedia, actually, I believe it's still on there now. The quote is, if I can read this back to you, "The film has been criticized for being random, incoherent, violently confusing, and lacking any plot whatsoever at any points." So I wanted to ask you, do you think, is the film even meant to be understood?
Yes, no, I got to tell you, I think that all the films that I've made successfully, which is to say, are the movies I want them to be.
Right.
I either get people loving them, and it's one of their favorite movies, or just loathing it. And I think from the beginning, because Attic did come up with the internet, you know, it came out in 2000 and 2001, really spread out over that year. It was a really interesting time because nobody really knew what that was going to be like to see the reviews coming out online. It wasn't like there was a community of horror directors who were like, just prepare yourself. You're going to get a lot of nasty reviews from kids. And from the time it came out and right when it was released, very nasty reviews and very much of the tone of that Wikipedia article.
Right.
And I will say this, that definitely has the tone of written by somebody who just doesn't like it. It sounds like some Seth Green fan most likely put that on there just to fill out the Seth Green shit, you know,
sure.
Make sure that everything he'd done has a page that links to. And, you know, I'm not going to bother to change that stuff because I think that's kind of the fun of the internet. But it's also indicative of the internet that if you look at, for example, the IMDb for Attic, the first maybe year of the reviews were vicious. And I'm proud to say, right, with spelling errors and kind of poorly written, crappy, dopey people being like, you know, not to brag, but I will say, it seemed like the dopier audience going, I don't get it, and this is stupid, and I hate this kind of movie.
Right.
I had a different and then, like, a year later, as, like, something starts to gain kind of more of a cult status, just the beginning of that groundswell of people writing, you people are dumb.
Yeah.
Actually, this is really interesting filmmaking, and movies that don't spoon-feed you every answer are so much more compelling, and that's what often makes for great filmmaking. Not, again, to say, oh, I'm a great filmmaker, but just to say, you know, to my way of thinking, that's often is the case, and that's what I tried to achieve, and it seemed like I was at least getting credit for doing that. And since then, I will say that it seems like most of the internet buzz on Attic, because narcissistically I do, you know, check up on it up from time to time and want to see what people are writing. It seems like it's been more and more positive, and the film is remembered now, you know, 7 years later, 8 years later, way more favorably than it was when it was first released. And I expect and hope that that'll continue.
Yeah, you know, it's strange when you're dealing with films in this kind of genre. You almost have to wait to see. Well, let me give you an example. We saw the Chicago premiere of Repo.
Yeah.
The Genetic Opera.
Sure.
And that's another one of those films that I think is made for a cult audience.
Yes.
And, you know, the critics are just like having a field day, and the Paris Hilton proverbial can has been opened. And, you know, people are just like, it's strange to see that kind of film come out and know that it's for a cult audience. And in making a film kind of for that genre, you almost don't, you know, the reviews that come out in the first couple of years don't even matter. You kind of have to wait, you know, for the next 5 years to see if people are still talking about it. And I think that's kind of strange.
Yeah. I mean, you to give this sort of penultimate, quote unquote, cult movie example or whatever, like Rocky Horror Picture Show was horribly received when it came out. And so is the case with most sort of cult movies. And you know, John Waters maybe being the exception because he had such a dedicated built-in audience from the early point. But mostly cult filmmakers, you know, for what it's worth and for whatever that term actually means, don't open to very warm reception. And hopefully it grows. And I think Repo is a great example of that.
So in our conversation, I think we've, you know, we came up with a lot of hypothetical ideas on the show of where the movie goes, depending on, you know, how you want to view certain things. So while I think we did a pretty good job of summarizing it, there's a couple questions I wanted to ask you to get these you know, definitive kind of final answers on the Attic expeditions.
Sure.
Really, we were going fine until the absolute ending, and that's where a couple things throw us off. Trevor appears to pull himself into the chest, and then directly after that, we have, you know, the end in the hospital mimicking the beginning of the film.
The suggestion is that because Trevor did not allow Faith to encourage him to take his own life and release him from his own mind, where he's trapped, he is now trapped in his own mind forever. He is comatose and looping within his own mind, the trunk in the attic, forever.
So is what we're seeing in the film him inside his own head?
I don't know.
I mean, is that the entire content of the film?
Yes, I don't know. Yes, that is what it is.
That's a good response. I like that.
Ultimately, that is what my reality for that movie is. We really wanted to and tried to make it a movie where it could be argued on three different realities. And I think that he's trapped in his own mind. There's the magic, the medical, and the outside of Trevor Eck reality.
Oh, good. That's fantastic. That's about right what we hit on with the show.
But, you know, it's very difficult, if not impossible, I will say, to make a movie without a definitive point of view.
Right.
I've heard people intelligently argue all three of those realities. But at the end of the day, I think that no matter what, you're sort of stuck with the medical on some level, because that's the one that I had to pick one and make that one the one that I was making stronger than the other ones. No matter what I did, I sort of still had to have a point of view. Even when I didn't want to, I had to.
There is your answer. No more emails, please. All right, so we've answered every possible question that everyone's ever had regarding the Attic expeditions. But if you're playing along at home, you know there's still one mystery this show is yet to solve.
The question that we've never really fully been able to answer, and the question that I'm going to pose to you right now is, what the fuck does a producer do?
On Attic Expeditions, the producers did so, so much. They raised money for the movie, which is, you know, first and foremost, one of the hardest things any human being could do in the world, in life. Raising money, which nobody really talks about, is the great mystery of filmmaking, is a horrible activity fraught with difficulty that sucks and hurts and makes you want to cry. And managing that money and managing the people who gave you that money is a whole nother level of difficulty that, you know, I'm always very grateful to have producers to do. On Attic Expeditions, the producers did so much, from dealing with, you know, petulant actors who were mad about, you know, the food or the dirty room that they had to change and sleep in, to, you know, managing the crew and the schedule and the locations. And you know what? I was creative and they made the movie. I mean, there really is very little that they don't do. I decide where the camera goes. I make the performances. I pick the colors and the story and that shit.
Sure.
And every fucking other thing, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, you know, and I was a producer on the movie too, and I did a lot to help the movie to get made, and I raised money and I managed that money and the business aspect. But day in and day out, making a movie with a cast of 8 or 9 and a crew of 20 or 30 people or more, it's insane. And moreover, on Attic, most of what we did for $0. We shot the entire movie on short ends of film that we'd gotten from commercials and other movies.
Oh, cool.
So there was no film virtually that we paid for, but just the year that we spent picking up short ends from commercial production companies and studios and paint. You know, we got fucking the used paint from Warner Brothers, and those dictated the colors. You know, we'd send the production designer to Warner Brothers to look through their recycled paint department and be like, yeah, this color will go with that color for Jeremy's color scheme. And crazy shit managing that for years, free food. And it was a huge thing they did on that movie.
Did they have a lot of creative input directly into the film, or just sort of indirectly with what they were managing?
Yeah, no, very indirectly. I think at one point, Dan Griffith, who is one of my best friends as well, and also was a producer on the movie, looked at, you know, we were still raising money and trying to shoot the movie, and he said, you know what, he was sort of putting his foot down. You can't do the street sequence with the houses all being the same. It was logistically so hard to do, and the digital side of it seemed impossible, and even getting our hands on a dead robin, like, being a pain in the ass.
And your response, of course, was, fuck that, we're doing it anyways.
Yeah. No, I was like, it's totally necessary for the movie. I have to have it. It really sets up an important thing.
Yeah, no, I mentioned that on the show. I love that scene.
Because the whole time, hopefully, people are wondering, why didn't he just fucking leave?
Yeah.
And so you have the, oh, because the world outside this world is even worse.
Yeah.
And I had to really go to bat for that. And I seem to recall it was really one of the only times that, and I'm not saying Dan's, you know, Dan's a very smart, very thorough producer, but it was like, he was so exasperated after 3 years of trying to get that movie made. It was, you know, for a producer, an intelligent thing to say is, do you really need this? But at the time, I really did. And that may be one of the only times that I remember one of the producers having a strong voice creatively, or attempting to have a strong voice creatively with Attic, which may be, you know, one of the failures of Attic is that it was so in my own head. And I've learned from that.
All right, Jeremy, I want to thank you a lot for coming on the show and talking with us about the Attic Expeditions. We'll have you on a bit later when we do the Wizard of Gore remake.
Sounds great.
So thanks a lot for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Well, if you're looking for films you don't understand, wait until we get to the fourth installment of Texas Chainsaw Massacre next time.
Oh, that's, yeah. So that is next, the very next show we are doing. Show 31, not show 30.
Yeah.
Like we previously fucked up. See the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies. We're watching every single one in existence.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
All right. So start, if you haven't started watching those, you have some catching up to do, but we are going to do those next time. And then after that, we're going to,
we got Spiral and Bad Santa the following.
All right. I think that sets up enough film for people to watch. So they need to get busy on that.
Yeah.
We also have a Facebook and a MySpace. Go find those. Be our friend and all that good stuff. And
watch more fucking film.
Bye.